Welcome back to the Lyme Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander. This is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts in all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's conversation is with the beautiful and talented Dr. Kelly Brogan. Dr. Kelly is a holistic psychiatrist. She is a New York Times bestselling author, and she is an incredibly wise woman that I'm very grateful to get to share a conversation with here with y'all. This conversation touches on tapping into sensuality and sexuality, releasing shame or guilt a person may be holding and not even realize that they are, how different psycho-emotional aspects of ourselves can manifest into various different forms of dis-ease in the body, and how to get under the hood of ourselves in that way and tap into a more expressed, more reclaimed, to use her language, version of ourselves. I think this conversation is a good one to send to a partner, send anybody in a relationship, just take some notes on with oneself and simmer on some of the ideas and concepts. I think it's a really valuable one. If you want to see the video version of this, jump over to the Align Podcast page on YouTube and subscribe over there. I greatly appreciate it. I also really enjoy checking out the comments and chiming in with them, and to get to have a more interactive experience with the podcast with y'all. Thank you for reviews. Thank you for sharing this. Thank you for joining you. Let's get to it with Dr. Kelly Brogan. I have a question in relation to medicine. I'm curious your perspective on the, what would you say that the most impactful source of disease in Western culture is per capita, like largest impact effect on our health in Western culture? If there was one thing that you had to pick, obviously it's a confluence of so many different variables and things. There's absolutely no one thing. But if there was one that stands out to you, what would stand out the most?
The installed program that you are broken / damaged / irreparably unworthy. Yeah. I found that actually focusing on the material building blocks of health, you know, that we call lifestyle in my practice, because when I started to see these women as their like full glorious expressed selves, I started to believe that they existed already in that state. And I'm not a clairvoyant or anything, but I could literally like perceive these glorious goddesses while they were coming to me, sometimes from state hospital on 5 meds they'd been on for 25 years, you know, having had multiple suicide attempts, etc. And all that I did was give them permission as the authority figure. And I held a lot of, I think, like, you know, positive animus energy, like, you know, benevolent father energy. It was kind of my vibe in my practice, actually. And I gave them permission to no longer believe that something is wrong with them. And of course, what comes with that is the responsibility to then decide, okay, so if nothing's wrong with me now, what? And there is a lot of dissolution that happens. And that's why I'm a big believer in ritual and containers to hold people through that process of reassembling a narrative about who they are that is not contingent on that core belief. But I never knew anything about, you know, beliefs and trauma. I was not even on that tip 15 years ago. And I saw that this was all that was necessary for me to sit there, look a woman in the eyes and say, let me tell you something. There's nothing wrong with you, and actually believe it and see what would happen within sometimes 30 days. So while there were attendant behavioral changes, you know, diet, et cetera, that I do believe was the first most important catalytic step. So it must mean that that is actually the core.
In reflecting on that within myself, I feel almost like some fear pop up at the idea that there's nothing wrong with me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's still cozy for me.
Like, it sounds terrifying. Like, wait, I mean, I don't have any excuse or anything to lean on, no crutches, yeah. You know, no stories that I've like kind of based my little strategies around for the last 30 years. Like, if they go away, like, who am I? What would I do?
100%. And that's why to recognize that our struggles actually meet fundamental needs. And I even like to take it a bit farther to suggest that they're actually pleasurable in many sensory and somatic ways. Our struggles, mm-hmm. meaning like when I get to feel like I am so fucked up that I'll never get to have X thing that somebody else yeah. has, there is a sequence of sensations in my body that is very arousing. Like it actually literally is. And if you pay attention the next time you're disappointed, exasperated, feeling resentful, like that's a big one. Disappointment and resentment for me are the most kinetic in my body. If you pay attention, there is a lot going on. And so if that's the closest you can get to your vital force, it's a wise strategy to continue to juice up that narrative, not consciously, obviously, but it works until the moment that it doesn't. And the moment that it doesn't is, you know, what I refer to as the rupture of empathy with whatever system is most reflecting to you your incapacity, ineptitude, and brokenness, which of course, as we're talking about it, is usually the allopathic system and sometimes the greenwashed integrative, you know, system of practitioners. And so when you start to recognize that they actually are invested in your dependency on this belief, at a certain point for some people, for reasons I don't totally understand that are mysterious, it just stops meeting the needs. And that's when they have the opportunity to embark on the heroine or hero's journey into the wild unknown through that terror. It is existentially terrifying to shed a story of identity and its associated beliefs. It just is. It's designed that way, I think. Hmm.
Where for a person that finds that hard to grok that I'm actually holding on to these patterns of self-sabotage as an adaptive strategy for myself, like at the root, it's a benign strategy to try to support me. Can you go deeper into why a person might subconsciously be doing that for someone that's kind of like, I don't think I'm sabotaging myself. Yeah. I don't think I'm like actively hurting myself. Come on. I love myself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you don't. nobody that I know, literally nobody that I know, maybe my best friend Tara, she's probably the closest, actually has an open channel to God, to source of total unconditional love and self-acceptance. So I don't know anybody who actually loves themselves. And what I would define that as is probably important, right? Is the total embrace of all of you, like literally all of your parts, seen and unseen. How do you know you have unseen parts? You experience conflict, tension, and judgment with other people, institutions, entities, etc. That's how you know, because from my perspective, you know, and this is a Jungian concept, you are projecting the parts of you that you reject onto these, you know, different sort of screens. And you're interacting with yourself. You're animating this person. Let's say it's an ex, or, you know, as a recovering activist, you know, in my case, it might be like the government or the elite or whatever you want to, you know, call it. So until we have embraced all of these dimensions of ourselves and really come with sober, curious, compassionate eyes to see how we are, you know, able to hold the tension of opposites, as he called it, as Jung called it, right? We're able to be both a good girl and a nasty bitch, right? We can't even have a sense of who we are, let alone apply, you know, this resonant state we call love. So I don't use the phrase self-sabotage, because I believe that the part that is responsible for maintaining the behavior that seems to be at the root of the problem has benevolent intent.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah. So
it's not sabotage as much as it's taking you back to the pain. And you're going to keep on replicating that until you actually address and integrate.
Yeah, of course.
And so you're not going to go to a higher level of ease, grace, you know, whatever the thing is, until you go back to that. So it'll seem like sabotage, but in fact, it's incredibly intelligent.
Yes,
exactly. That is my perception of it.
Totally. And so you asked for an example. An example might be, you know, like if I have, let's say I have chronic migraines, okay? There is a part of me that believes that I must have these chronic migraines. Like I actually must, that's ridiculous. Why? Like, it's horrible. It's horrible for the whole self. Like, why would that ever be, you know, a strategy that has any sense to it? But if you think about, you know, on a higher level, what is conferred by a chronic illness like that? If you're somebody who never could assert your independence, your individuality, right, that was discouraged, which was the case for most of us in our, you know, families of origin, where we were expected to enmesh with our parents and collude with their reality, then boundaries and saying no, just because no, are really tough, right? Even for like a big mouth like me, my boundary journey, you can't imagine like how many absurd, my girlfriends are like rolling in the aisles laughing at the absurd situations I get in because of, to this day, how difficult it is for me to say no. Unless I'm angry, right? But I'm talking about a different kind of boundary. Like, let's say you have a friend you don't really want to spend time with and they ask you out to dinner and you're like, oh, what does it cost me? I might as well just go. I haven't seen her in a while. But if you have a migraine, you don't have to learn how to say no. You just can be sick, right? So your illness can confer that sense of containment, self-containment, and no boundaries, like NO. And then it also confers like yes, right? I like to think in those polarities where the yes is to feel seen, right? Almost all of my patients told me at some point that when they were first diagnosed, they felt validated. Because when your struggle has a label, you can get other people to see, honor, and respect your struggle in a way that perhaps you don't know how to ask for. Otherwise, the caretaking, the attention, the sense of even significance that is derived from this surrogate identity. So illness meets those needs as well. And yeah. It is a wise strategy until something else is available, right? Like yeah. we just do, like, let's say I have a friend to try a different example. Let's say I have a friend who is always late. Whenever we meet up, she's like always late and it's super fucking annoying. And I get triggered every time. And I make like, you know, sarcastic comments to her about like, you know, was she like, does she not live in the same city as me? Like, we have the same traffic. Like, why did you leave when you leave? You know, I make these offhand comments to her and I do that and I feel resentful and I feel frustrated and I start to develop like negative feelings towards her because of it. All of that is because it is way too vulnerable for me to just say something like, you know what? I would feel so loved by you if you would show up on time when we meet up. I would feel like you really care about me. Are you willing to do that? Oh, like most of us could never consider a direct ask like that. It is way too vulnerable. So yeah. When you have another way of, you know, corralling that vulnerable desire and longing, and you can meet the needs kinda, you're going to do that. And it makes sense. So I don't believe in mistakes. I don't believe in accidents. Like, I actually believe all of this is in service of the meeting of needs that we are not consciously ready to acknowledge, let alone learn the skillful means to address directly with other humans.
Yeah. All that brings up, I'm actually recording with Marianne Williamson, I think Wednesday this week. And one of the quotes, probably our most like repeated quote, is the bit about you're not afraid. Your greatest fear isn't of being inadequate. It's that you're powerful beyond measure or something like that. And that, like, it seems silly, but like for me, I like feel that in my body of like, what would happen if I had to step into the responsibility of full ownership of myself without any excuses or any kind of like crutches. As like, no, like this is actually the fullest, most abundant, expressed version of myself. Take it or leave it. Compared to the safety of always kind of walking with a limp, yeah. You know, and like, oh, you know, I used to be really good, but now I've got this limp, you know? So it's, I think what it feels like to me is like a really beautiful protective measure to guard your ego, you know, or guard like that, like inner child that doesn't want to get left behind or doesn't want to prove that he's not lovable or she's not lovable, or, you know, it doesn't feel Is that resonating?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that I conceptualize it is as a mother wound for women anyway. I can really only speak as a woman to women, and I'm super curious about
I speak for both men and
you
women.
You speak for all.
I speak for all.
I've learned my lesson. I've learned my lesson about trying to speak for
proceed.
But regardless, I think of it as stemming from a mother wound, right? Because the part of the mother wound, I'm like a simple gal, right? I know I don't maybe seem that way to everybody, but I like to distill things down. And for me, the mother wound is I'm not loved. Period. The end. If you got that in you, you've got a mother wound. And the father wound is I'm not safe. And this is a lot of, you know, I have a book coming out in June called The Reclaimed Woman. And a lot of what I am on about these days is the sort of plot twist about women interested in accessing more femininity and their feminine energy, right? And that we think, many of us, that it's like a course we have to take or, you know, a retreat we have to go to or something we have to just try to prioritize pleasure and slowness more, right? And then you get sucked into the mill of, you know, productivity and doing and achievement and serving others and self-abandoning. But the plot twist to me is that it's really about safety first. Right. So if you're a woman who does not receive well, does not know how to ask for help, does not know how to slow down and do absolutely nothing without guilt, you don't have a femininity problem, right? Deficiency. You have to mature your masculine nature, right? So that container, that containment, you can provide yourself that safety in ways that are actually quite mundane and simple. And I could give examples, but until that happens, there is like this unqualified, immature, like little adolescent dude, you know, at the helm, and he's scanning all the time, like kind of freaking out, like just not in his spine, right? Like he doesn't have his balls, right? Like that guy is at the helm of your ship inside of you as a woman, right? And so that adolescent masculine, if you will, because I think of it maturationally, is going to perceive danger in the same way that you did as a child, which is my mama absolutely does not want me to be bigger, bolder, more audacious, more beautiful, more expressed than her. It's not going to feel good to her. Because she has an unlived life that we are supposed to handle together with care, right? Like she wants me to be me. She loves me. And in the end, she only has a mold of herself that she can pour me into. So when I am touching up against the upper limits and the ceiling of my expression, that punishment alarm is going to go off. And it's possible to pretty easily start to work with this through simple things like finding one friend that you can like big up yourself to, right? Finding one friend that you can celebrate yourself with and like really make a concerted effort to, you know, leave her a voice note once a week where you talk about like an amazing thing that happened, you know, in your life, in your relationship, in your business, as a mother, with your pets, in your garden, whatever it is. And you really, without qualification, just offer, this is awesome, you know, about my life. And, you know, there's some rewiring that begins to happen when you experience, if you choose the right person, that there's no punishment and that she's not jealous. She can handle it. She actually wants that for you and she wants to celebrate with you. You know, I had an experience in my last house. I had a generator, right? And so I'm in Miami and the lights went out and I go to look outside. I'm home alone and I go to look outside and it's like pitch. I didn't even know Miami could get this dark. It was pitch, pitch, pitch black. And my house clicks on and I have like, of course, as you do, like fuchsia landscape lighting. And I have like, you know, these kinds of fairy lights everywhere. And my house is lit up like an absurdity, right? It's like a circus tent. And it's the only one on the entire block. And my first reflex was, somebody's going to come get me. And it was so irrational that I was able to see it and be like, first of all, that makes zero sense, because if somebody's going to come get anybody, it's going to be in the dark houses, right? Like not in the lit up house. But I was able to see, oh, I have more than my neighbor or my neighbor or my neighbor. I have a generator, right? Which I don't know if anybody knows anything about generators, but they like cost tens of thousands of dollars. It was like a real homesteading investment. Like it was a thing, right? And so I had that and they didn't. And that felt like something I was going to be punished for. I mean, so mundane and silly, but you can see these little programs that crop up when you do the audacious, I love that word, but when you do the audacious thing or you behave in a way that is like riskily bold, there absolutely, for most of us, will be a part of you that says, get back down, you know, into your comfortable place. And so that's why I believe in like titrating into the baby steps experiences of like, you know, can I tell you something amazing? And I watch, you know, watch your face and I can really see like, you're excited for me, like authentically excited for me. And it's okay if I have more than you because you have more of other things than me. And this is just what we're here for. We're here to try things out, you know, and have experiences. And can you like sign up for mine, right? So that is, it's a maturational phenomenon that I know women must go through. And I imagine exceeding your father is a similar challenge and task for men.
I want to take a moment and share about a device that I utilize most days of the week when I'm at my place here in Austin, Texas. That is my Sunlight and Infrared Sauna. I've got it sitting in the backyard beside the cold plunge. I am a huge fan of this because with infrared sauna, you're getting different benefits than that of a traditional Finnish style sauna that's going to be getting hotter. The infrared sauna, you're going to be getting more benefits with collagen repair, collagen synthesis, things of the like. So if you're looking for mitochondrial health, you're looking for tissue repair, you're looking for healthier, more vital appearing skin and more elastic, more well hydrated, the infrared is a really fantastic tool. I really enjoy both traditional sauna and infrared for different reasons. If you're going to get an infrared sauna, I think Sunlight is the way to go. They have lower EMF output compared to most of the infrared saunas that I am familiar with. And I specifically use the Amplify from Sunlight. This model I like the best for me because it contains an external heating unit. So there's two external heating panels inside there. So you're getting a blend of the heat that you get from a traditional sauna with the benefits of infrared. So if you have interest in getting yourself a discount up to $600 off, you can go to sunlighten.com. And then when you go to the get pricing form, fill in align promo code, you'll get up to $600 off of your purchase. I hope you guys enjoy it. I use mine literally almost every day. If I'm here, I'm using it all the time. I think you guys dig it. Sunlighten.com, align in the get pricing form, and get up to $600 off your purchase. As you're talking, something came up. I wonder, speaking of like that you can only speak for women, is anything stand out? If there was one thing that maybe men don't know about women's experience that would be supportive for men to know?
Oh, I love this question. This is the question. I was just saying this the other day to my friend that this is the question we were never asked by our parents. And if there is a question that can heal, I mean, I can't tell you, I could literally list like 25 relationships in my life since I've been like cleaning up my life the past couple of years that I have restored to integrity with that simple question. Like, is there anything, like a variation of it, right? Like, is there anything that I need to know, you want me to know? Right. And like, I teach as a mother, like the most powerful question you can ask your kids is like, can you tell me more? Right. So most of our parents didn't do that because they couldn't capacitate a reality that would otherwise threaten or potentially displace theirs. They couldn't hold the tension of opposites. I think it's a physiologic thing. Like you literally need to have nervous system capacity to hold these energies, right? So I love that question. And the immediate response that comes to me is that we are wired biologically to be afraid of you. It's the reality, the biological reality that every woman, heterosexual or not, who walks this plane lives with, is that a man can snuff her out with, you know, his bare hands if she behaves in a way that he doesn't approve of. That's the vast majority of men are capable of doing that to the vast majority of women. And so if this vulnerability is innate, then it makes a lot of sense that we would develop all sorts of defensive strategies to secure what we deem as, you know, a modicum of safety. And most of those strategies look like manipulation, right? Deceit. They look like shaming. I think that the shadow that women bring to match the shadow of healthy masculine aggression is that we have the capacity to shame men. I've certainly done that in my decades. You know, when I feel threatened in or out of relationship, I will unleash my power to slice and dice a man and serve his head on a platter because I am good at that. Most women are. We know how to hit you where it hurts. And it's a developed compensation for what is ultimately a physical vulnerability, I believe. And, you know, Jordan Peterson and others talk about this. This is not my conceptualization, but I know it to be true. And until I acknowledge that reality, I couldn't see that fear was underpinning pretty much my entire activist career, right? Mm-hmm. For like over a decade that I had been, you know, really fighting the system. And specifically, I would say the pharmaceutical industry, I just thought I was doing it because I wanted to get the truth out. But there was an energy beneath that actually perpetuated and propagated. And I'm not saying that doesn't serve because all the flavors are needed, right? There's no right and wrong way to relate to reality and truth. I'm not here to say like I'm better now, certainly, because I don't believe that. However, at the time, it could be argued that in my focus on exposing all of the nefarious activities of this, you know, allopathic industry, I actually just passed the hot potato of fear because I felt like a small girl threatened by a big authority, right? So I was projecting my parental stuff like onto these institutions and guilds and whatever you want to call them. And I was in that adolescent rebellion, right? Until one day I recognized, and this was around the time that my mentor died very suddenly, Nick Gonzalez in 2015, I recognized that it just all felt terrible, right? Like everything I was doing, my practice, my activism, and I looked around me at all the activists around me and I was like, all of their lives are so fucked up and they're so unwell in their lives, like in their relationships, in their marriages. Like we are just a hot mess trying to tell the world how we believe the world should be. And that is when I made a shift that I still nurture today, which is into celebration, you know, of what is possible. It just feels better to me to do that. And so, you know, the strategies for developing a sense of inner biological safety and what I would call like the reclamation of neuroception, right? Or my capacity to perceive with accuracy whether something is dangerous or safe, right? Whether it's a pile of clothes on the chair in the dimly lit bedroom or it's an intruder, right? Yeah. My capacity to reclaim that is, it requires physical healing, like I was saying, you know, and then it requires setting the conditions for, you know, that what I call self-containment or self-husbanding or this concept of like, how do I begin to bring safety to my system as a woman so that I can look around and choose safe circumstances, safe relationships, safe partners, and accurately perceive that so that I'm not walking the world vigilant all the time.
Yeah. Then the neuroception is like a Stephen Porges term. I think he coined that. And so from polyvagal theory, which I'm sure we've talked about to some degree on here before, within that, the highest leverage tool to get a person to come into more of a place of like ventral vagal tone or calm, relaxed, parasympathetic state. One of the big guns for that would be cooperative play, and to be able to like trust connecting with someone, and you're sharing facial affect and body language, and you're attuning to each other. And like that actually is like a massage for your nervous system. And you're also learning healthy boundaries, and you're learning to trust. And it's like, there's so much magic that's transpiring in that. And we put, you know, scientific words on it, but there's so much more than just the handful of words that I just, you know, used. But to get to that point of trusting it's safe to connect with someone, for some people, they have a lot of cleanup to do within themselves. And simultaneously, you can do a lot of that cleanup in the reflection of another person. Yeah, so it's like, I think both is right. Like all that matters, I think, is probably just developing maybe compassion for yourself.
Curiosity. You know,
or like,
yeah.
Like
awareness. Yeah.
Yeah. Something I want to, I think it's kind of interesting because we have about 30 minutes left, and I want to talk about like sex and eroticism and all sorts of provocative things. It seems to me like coming to the point of sensuality and eroticism and, you know, fantasies being expressed and such, particularly for a woman, would be kind of the visualization that's coming to mind is almost like it's like the flower. Mm-hmm. Of a plant. And so it's like in spring, the flower comes up and it opens up. It's like, oh, but it's being supported by the stem and by the roots and by the soil and all of the care to come to that point.
Yes.
And I think and I would imagine a lot of that is, you know, trust and safety would probably be like a major foundation for that. And then for a guy, I think a guy kind of, he starts with the flower more than the woman. And for a guy, it's like, if I get sex and I get eroticism and I get fantasies kind of unveiled to me, I want to lean in, you know, and I want to take care and I want to support and I want to like do all of the things. That's obviously not an absolute in either direction, but it's a little bit conflicting.
Yeah. I think one of the places we see that the most, I don't know how familiar you are with Jaya's erotic blueprints.
Yeah, I've gone through her stuff. I've been pretty involved with Jaya's things. She's also done a bunch of podcasts here.
Oh, amazing. Okay, so then I have to, what type are you?
Oh, good question. I think I'm all the things. I kind of like I've evolved into pretty much like, I guess, shapeshifter would be the terminology for it. But I think I was just pretty basic bitch, like sexual.
Yeah. Exactly.
I like.
So, but it's so helpful, right? To have this language, because a lot of men are sexual types, which is, you know, for people who haven't heard it, you know, for a sexual type, sex is literally like breathing. I mean, it's like that essential and needs to be that regular, and it's actually very orgasmically focused, and there's not a lot of prelude, right? Like the foreplay is irrelevant. It could be a bathroom. It could be a car. It doesn't matter, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of women are energetics or sensuals. And an energetic, for example, needs, you know, like the hovering hands, like needs the anticipation of the kiss to linger, needs like you to enter the room slowly, eye contact, needs to breathe with you, right? And a sensual is like, you know, needs the temperature of the room to be perfect, needs the scent of the room to be perfect, needs the lighting and the music. And then, you know, her vital force starts to unlock and her eros comes online. So you could imagine, you know, wow, we're just sexually incompatible people. And there is like a whole language. It's learning a dialect. There's a whole language you can learn about a partner, for example, to bridge, you know, to create the connection between these polarities. But if you don't even understand that concept, then you take it personally and you imagine, you know, oh, I guess this is just how men are, this is just how women are, and you start to generalize. And I think it's so powerful to get to know yourself in that way. And it's such a path to self-discovery. I mean, I remember when I first did couple years ago, like body mapping exercises, like I discovered just with myself, and I've had an erotic coach for a couple of years, Whitney, and just to discover these dimensions of my own vessel, you know, that I should have in some world known this as like a 15-year-old, and I have a 15-year-old, and I encourage her all the time, you know, like, now is the time to get to know your body in this way, so that you can have that intimacy with self that will be reflected then, you know, when you're playing with somebody else.
For a fella, how could, if my flower analogy is appropriate, how could a fella cultivate the soil and the stem and like the proliferation of the rest of the flower to support a gal in feeling safe enough to express in a sensual way, or, you know, to fulfill some of those like fantasies that the fellas probably would be, you know, prefer to experience or would be enamored by.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite teacher on this subject I've followed for over a decade is David Deida. And so I certainly would point people in the direction of his teachings for a more nuanced perspective. But I would say that I have learned the most about this through the BDSM and conscious kink community, because, you know, I've been actually celibate for a couple of years now. And so it's not like I've been in the community, like having real experiences, but I've gone to retreats and I've learned, and I'm very anthropological. So I can like pick things up in a way that I can then weave into so many other dimensions of the victim consciousness study I've been making, you know, of my entire career. And what I have found is that the containers that are created are very explicit, right? For communication, for consent. And to many of us, that seems like not hot, right? Like, who wants to have like do a fucking checklist, you know, before you have an experience with somebody? But most of us only talk about sex and our preferences when there's a problem, right? Like after there is like something that feels not quite right, rather than setting the conditions, you know, for both partners to win, right? So otherwise you're engaging in mind reading, right? So if I, you know, if you were my husband and I wanted to have an experience of you taking the lead planning dinner for us, right? I could say that in so many ways. I could be like, you never plan dinner. Can you please plan something this week, right?
Or I could shaming.
Yeah, right. And talking about like what's wrong with your behavior, leading with that.
Yeah.
Or I could say like, hey, let's go to dinner. Right. So it's like this passive kind of like mealy mouth, like what actually is the request? Or I could say, I'd love for you to take me to dinner. Mm-hmm. And if you're like a super, you know, resource creative guy, that might be all you need. But if I really want to set you up for success, I'm going to say, I would love for you to take me to dinner on Thursday. And I'm really feeling either sushi or Indian. Right. Then you can't fucking lose, right? Like you're going to win for sure, guaranteed slam dunk, because you're going to pick an either a sushi place or an Indian place. And you know already what my desires are, what my preferences are. So I think that's where most of us need to start, because otherwise what you're asking is, I mean, I think it's the moment we're in as a collective right now, which is like, how do we heal across the divide between men and women? How do we, you know, work with the masculinization of women and the feminization of men? What do we do from here? Because the free energy technology that is available through erotic dyad is under assault. You know, there is a reason that 70% of marriages are ending. There is a reason that people are choosing not to couple in that way. There is a reason that we have all of the, you know, questions arising, shall I say, about sex and gender, et cetera. And one of the primary antidotes is that men learn attunement, right? So this is big in the BDSM community, is the Dom's attunement to his sub. What does that mean? It means that you feel your own body as you're feeling hers. You're like literally able to feel, right? And to observe with that degree of specificity. So, you know, so you grab her ankles and you just see a little like twitch next to the side of her mouth, right? She's closing. right? Mm-hmm. You run your hands through her hair and she slacks her jaw. Oh, she's opening, right? So sometimes it's something you can see with your eyes. Sometimes it's something you just feel, like it's her vital force energy. You're attuning to that and you know that you can calibrate, right? But that level of play only becomes available when there is clear delineation of roles. Anyway, this is what I've observed, right? So like, who is the leader? As my friend Kimmy Inch would say, like, who's the leader? Who's the follower? Is that interesting to get organized into those roles? Or do we just want to like assume that, you know, and mind read? I think for most of us, that ends up offering an experience where both people are performing and nobody's actually experiencing ecstasy, right? Like nobody's actually going where we know in our hearts it's possible to go. And attunement requires a sound system in a man. So it comes back to, you know, the Borges work we were talking about. It comes back to like, how regulated is your system, right? That's why things like breath work and martial arts and, you know, Vipassana and these kinds of, you know, intensive endeavors for men hold extraordinary promise for their experience as lovers. Because when you can have a still, quiet system and you can focus your attention outward, you're going to know exactly what to do in that moment. And then the woman gets to focus her attention and attunement inward. Maybe that's her only responsibility, is to feel what's happening in her body and express it, you know, in the most amplified, generous way.
That's really good. Something that in listening and preparing for talking with you, I was listening to some other conversations you've had and heard you mention that when you went to a pole class, you were like very insecure with your legs and like the idea of like other girls in the room seeing your butt, you found to be like totally absurd and like you're quite uncomfortable with it. And it became a very emotional experience. And there was a lot of emotion for you, it seemed, from living this like previous version or iteration of yourself being much more, probably like more in your masculine, more in your kind of like covering up and defensiveness, which obviously was probably protecting, you know, something or some things. And the transition into starting to make yourself more vulnerable and open to sensuality and being like open and expressive with that and being witnessed in that seemed like it was very impactful for you. Am I misspeaking? And if I'm not, do you see that with other women and men? And would there be any suggestions you provide for people to tap into that like sensual aspect mm-hmm. of themselves and feel safe, you know, and not ashamed to do so?
Oh, I love this question. So part of the maturation of the masculine for me, right? Because I'm not like getting rid of my masculine traits. They certainly have, like, it's just my yang, right? It's an energetic signature within me that wants complementarity and then wants to be like organized into, right? Who's leading, who's following.
The power of choosing, I think, is like a really important thing. And I think that that's something that I've heard different iterations of this idea as well. That's like, you're either 100% in or nothing. Like if you're like 98% in, the person on the other side of that, including yourself, receives that memo, and you're just going to be in this frictive kind of battle of both people kind of like hedging their bets, you know, and creating more instability. And you're just going to ride that until eventually, you know, either choose or split.
There are three things that must be in place in order to be sure that you are seeing your partner or potential partner with sober eyes and minimizing projections. It's not possible to eliminate them all together. But the first is that you are a 100% yes to who that person is as they are today. Like not when they get sober. I hope they do some shadow work. It'd be great if they, you know, did some plant medicine. No, who they are right now, today. You have to be 100% yes to their parents. Right? Especially if they're living. So if they have issues with their parents, you don't collude with them against their parents because they are made of their parents, right? So 100% yes to their parents, which of course is like it's almost like normalized now that you have like issues with your in-laws kind of a thing, right? And then you're 100% yes to having separate destinies, which means that you love this person not just because of what they give you in relationship, but because their existence allows you to feel a greater sense of belonging on this plane, period. Whether you're together, not together, doesn't matter. So when you have those in place, then you have such a greater capacity to know whether it is that you're choosing somebody. And just like you said, we that's the longing. It's to be fully, fully, fully chosen. And the ambivalence around it is just a reflection of our own rejection of whatever it is that we're judging in that person. And there comes a moment, perhaps in everybody's life, where they have the opportunity to choose a partner, maybe even one they've been with for 20 years, right? You can wake up on a Wednesday and truly choose that person. I've seen, you know, friends do this. I know it's possible.
I love that. Thank you so much. I look forward to getting to do this in person at some point coming down the line. Yeah. And thank you all for tuning in. That's it. That's all. I'll see you next week. Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. If you would like to see the video version of this and the rest of the episodes, jump over to the Align podcast page on the YouTube. Be sure to subscribe over there. I greatly appreciate it. It's very supportive. And thank you once again for reviews. Thanks for sharing it. Thanks for doing you. I will see you next week.